From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Guy Raz. This episode, a look at breast cancer and where we are in the search for a cure.
We've been focusing not on eradicating breast cancer, we've been focusing on finding it and curing it.
Also, the bleak future of traditional children's books, the website Record Setter, which accepts submissions for just about any record, and a new running game where you get chased by zombies.
Run a five, there's a child stuck in no man's land. Run to get them before the zombies come.
Rawr.
Plus, Bloodland, a new Irish political thriller, and country singer Gretchen Peters' wrenching new record, Hello, Cruel World.
I haven't done as well as I thought I would. I'm not dead, but I'm damaged goods.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
I'm a rusty hinge, a squeaky wheel, at the bad end of a shaky deal.
We begin today with the story of a family. Meet the Grants.
My name is Tracy Grant, and I live in New York City, Harlem to be exact. I'm 48 years old, and I am a breast cancer survivor.
Tracy was just 39 when she got the diagnosis.
They asked me to stay a little bit longer because they saw something a little weird. And in my mind, I was saying, Here we go. This doesn't look good.
As devastating as the news was, it wasn't a surprise. That's because of her family history. Meet Tracy's mom.
I'm Catherine Grant. I'm 74 years old. I'm a native Washingtonian, and I'm a breast cancer survivor twice. The first diagnosis was age 51. That seems to be a magic number. For us, it's always in the 50s.
By us, Catherine means most of the women in her family. Her mother had it, three of her sisters, her daughter Tracy, three generations of Grant women. Catherine says the whole family works to try to break that pattern.
We do the walks, we give. We're just waiting, hopefully, that something will come. And then sometimes I hear people say, there's so much money that's given all the time. Why can't they find a cure? And I said, I have no idea.
It's an honest question, and it's our cover story today. How far have we come, and where are we headed in the search for a cure to breast cancer? The last few years have brought advances in the treatment of breast cancer. They have also brought confusion. New federal recommendations have left many women unsure when they should start getting screened and what options they have if cancer is diagnosed. We reached out to Dr. Larry Norton. He's deputy physician in chief for breast cancer programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I asked, in his view, when should a woman start getting mammograms?
If your goal is to reduce your odds of dying of breast cancer, and to reduce your odds of needing a mastectomy, if that is your goal, then an annual mammogram starting at age 40 for your average risk woman is the best way to go.
There's also, I think, a lot of confusion among women who receive a diagnosis over mastectomy, whether to have one, how much that may improve your rate of survival. What advice would you give?
For a patient who's a candidate for breast conservation, mastectomy does not improve the cure rate. So that there are good reasons why somebody may choose mastectomy, but for most women with small tumors, improving the chance of cure is not one of those reasons. Of course, this has to be individualized. There are medical reasons why mastectomy is a good idea. Having more than one tumor in the breast, for example, a very large tumor in a relatively small breast is an example, and so on. Sometimes we find precancerous changes in the breast, and that's not true cancer, but doing a mastectomy removes those precancerous changes so we can prevent those cells from turning into cancer. So there are good reasons. But for most people who are diagnosed with cancer, especially those with smaller tumors, breast conservation gives exactly the same cure rates as doing mastectomy, and therefore going to mastectomy is not going to be beneficial in terms of cure for that individual.
Let me press you on innovations in care and treatment once a breast cancer is diagnosed. For years it has been mastectomy or aggressive chemical treatment, chemotherapy, et cetera. What specifically has changed in terms of once breast cancer is diagnosed, what treatment options are out there?
It's a whole package of approach that really works.
Okay.
You need better surgery so that you know you've gotten the mass of tumor cells out. You need better radiation so that you are killing any cancer cells that are in the regional area completely with minimal toxicity to the patient. And you need better drug therapy, which can be hormones alone for certain individuals, and we can tell this by looking at the biology of the cancer. It can be chemotherapy, which is much less toxic than it ever was before because we can eliminate things like low blood counts and we can eliminate nausea and vomiting in most cases. But we're also looking at new therapies such as immune stimulation, making the cancer itself stimulate the immune system and unleashing the blockade that your cells may have, your immune cells may have, so that they don't attack your own tissues. We could release that blockade. So that there are a lot of very exciting things that are moving forward, and it's all based on a new understanding of the biology of cancer.
Dr. Larry Norton of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. So that's a quick update on treatments. But what about a cure? Dr. Baron Lerner is an internist and medical historian at Columbia University. His book is called The Breast Cancer Wars. He says the idea of a cure means different things to different people.
There's certainly the individual cure of a patient. So someone who gets the disease, gets treated successfully, and is cured. And then there's the larger issue of almost eradication of a disease or getting rid of it from the environment. And that's obviously the much more challenging goal. It's happened in a couple of cases. The disease that people always talk about is smallpox, where it used to exist all over the place, and then eventually it disappeared. But it's much, much harder with other diseases.
When we talk about breast cancer, where does the effort, where does the search for a cure stand?
People are talking about two types of things, I think, broadly. One is maybe a cancer vaccine, a breast cancer vaccine to prevent the disease, or cleaning up the environment and removing environmental toxins that are probably linked to the incidence of breast cancer.
Depending on what may have been the cause for an individual case of breast cancer, does that change the way you would want to treat it?
You're pushing right in the right direction, because what we're learning now, since there are different types of breast cancer that increasingly can be identified by their genetic makeup, it stands to reason that different treatments would work better for those different cancers. And we're only at the beginning stages of developing these more focused and specific treatments. But the idea is to try to replicate that system of finding a specific breast cancer and finding a specific treatment for all breast cancers.
I wonder, to what extent does funding drive the research? Is one challenge getting pharmaceutical companies and securing federal funding to focus on the goal of eradication of the disease versus better drugs to treat it once it's diagnosed?
This is a real important issue, and a lot of groups have been pushing in this direction and really trying to change the paradigm, trying to get the rate of breast cancer to go down by itself so we don't have to do all this aggressive treatment. Getting research funding into those areas is much more of a challenge.
And why is that?
Many reasons. One is they're much harder studies to do. It's easy to put two drugs against each other and follow a group of women out. It's much harder to do studies, for example, of what sort of toxins in the environment might be causing breast cancers in a group of women. In studies like that, you've got to interview people, try to figure out what they've been exposed to for how long a period, and then you have to follow them for years and years. They're very, very difficult studies to do, and they're not very sexy from the perspective of a pharmaceutical company. Why would a pharmaceutical company want to fund that? And there's limited federal dollars for this sort of research. But that's absolutely a productive way that we should be pushing.
Dr. Lerner, the advice that a lot of women get tends to focus heavily on prevention, on early detection, as we've been talking about. You know, we're all told, eat well, don't smoke, get screened, you know, get your recommended mammograms. It does seem that in the race for the cure doesn't really get discussed that much.
That's true. I think the challenge is to try again to look at the bigger picture. What's clear is, even though the mortality has gone down and is under 40,000 deaths a year, there's still, we could say, hundreds of thousands of new cases of breast cancer a year, regardless of the screening technique that you're talking about. And the incidence of breast cancer, the number of cases, has stayed roughly the same in that range for many, many decades, really.
Despite all of these decades of research and funding and trying to turn that those numbers around.
That's exactly what you'd expect, because we've been focusing not on eradicating breast cancer. We've been focusing on finding it and curing it. So that's why the rates of the disease haven't changed, but the death rate has gone down. So we've done a good job of finding cancers once they're there and treating them. We haven't done as good a job of saying, how do we prevent these cancers from occurring in the first place?
Dr. Baron Lerner of Columbia University. That focus he mentioned on finding and treating breast cancer has benefited women like Tracy Grant. Her cancer was caught early, and she never had to endure some of the most painful treatments that older generations of her family did.
I feel tremendously blessed because I had these matriarchs before me. You know, I watched them go through such a difficult time in the chemotherapy, and I was prepared. And I had a double mastectomy, which is nothing to sneeze at, but I did not have to go through chemo or any medication. I was very, very lucky.
Tracy's mom, Catherine, puts it a different way. The two-time cancer survivor looks healthy, beautiful today at age 74, and she says that while the disease is part of her family's history, it does not define them.
Believe it or not, and this might sound a little strange, but when we have family gatherings, the breast cancer never comes up.
Really?
No.
That surprises me.
No.
It's something you all have in common, or so many
of
you.
Yeah, we know we have it. As long as everyone is healthy and there are no problems, you know, somebody might say, well, so-and-so has a cold. Well, yeah, we might talk about that. But breast cancer, no, we don't. We never just sit down and have conversations about breast cancer, because we've all just adjusted to living with it. And we've moved on.
Catherine Grant, talking about three generations in her family who have fought breast cancer. And by the way, they all beat it. So here's a conundrum for parents. If you have kids, you get told over and over, limit their screen time. And you're also told, instead of screen time, get them reading more, which is all well and good, except that these days many children do their reading on a screen, which raises some interesting questions about how children read today and what direction things are headed in children's book publishing. To help us out, we've called Dan Poynter. He's the author of The Self-Publishing Manual and 126 other books. He says kids are still reading traditional printed books, but 13% of children's book sales are now e-books, and that number is rising.
And by the way, 11 million parents have purchased an e-book, and 19.6 million parents plan to buy an e-book, so the numbers are huge.
Which makes sense. Kids like to look at screens. But that's not the only reason e-books are flooding the market. They're also way cheaper to produce.
Printing and transporting paper is very expensive, and e-books eliminate the expensive four-color printing, the higher quality paper, the ocean shipping, the customs clearance, the inventory, answering the telephone, writing up the orders, picking, packing, and shipping, and managing all of these functions. So we eliminate a huge number of costs and the chance that those books won't sell.
All of that means Dan is not optimistic about the future of printed books.
Run a test. Give a five-year-old a printed book and an iPad and see what happens. That five-year-old is going to go right for the iPad. They're not intimidated by it. They know what to do with it. They'll start searching around. And in a children's e-book, you can have links to kids' safe encyclopedias. So if they click on the lion, it takes them to Africa and tells them all about lions. So now the e-book is educational.
Not all authors are embracing the new technology. One who is, wholeheartedly, is Roxy Monroe. She had written traditional children's books for years, mostly search and find books, maze books, that type of thing. And then,
about 5 years ago, I got an email fan letter from a guy in the Netherlands who had a five-year-old son.
Huh.
And he loved the maze books. And about 18 months ago, I got an email from the fellow again, who owns a graphics company, and he wanted to dip his toes into apps and thought that my books would be perfect.
When you first saw, you know, your book that you were used to seeing as a printed book, when you first saw the electronic version, what did you think? What was your reaction?
I was just loved it. I mean, I just thought that that's what it should be, have been all along.
I want to ask you, we were taking a look here at one of the apps you have out. This is called Doors. It was originally a printed book that you created. And the printed book, I assume it was a kind of a lift the flap type book. You could open the door that way. Is that right?
Yes, paper engineered.
Lift the flaps and step through doors into wonderful worlds that you can explore.
That sizzling sound is the space shuttle door opening up. And then the door there opens up to the fire station.
Think of sirens. Think of red. Call the station, someone said. Find a flashlight and a glove. A first aid kit that's stored above.
You see a guy coming down a pole. A dog barks.
And look for a hat and an apple, too.
And the child's able to actually, they're moving their finger across the screen and picking where they want to go next and finding objects.
They can make the horn blow or the lights come out.
Now, Roxy admits not all children's books lend themselves to e-versions.
For example, studies have been done where if it's just a story and you're reading it, but some things are animated that aren't pertinent to the story and the child gets distracted just touching everything, they have found that they actually retain less of the story and read it less well.
Oh, really?
So it really depends upon the content and what the book is all about.
So might there be a future, even a bleak one, for old-fashioned printed kids' books?
Well, I don't think they're dead. But frankly, I think within one generation, maybe 30 years, very few houses will have bookshelves, and people will have libraries. A few people will have libraries just like they collect art or stamps or fine prints. So there'll be libraries, private libraries, and there'll be public libraries. But I don't think, sadly, that the average house will have a bookshelf in 30 years.
Which is sad, isn't it? I put the question to our publishing expert, Dan Pointer. Do you think anything is lost in this transition?
Well, sure, if you're a printer or a trucker.
if you're a kid or a parent. I mean, I would miss, for example, I have little kids, and I would miss some of the, I think some of the big colorful illustrations are hard to capture on a small screen, or some of the tactile things. Some of the, you know, you touch Pat the Bunny and he feels furry. You can't do that on a screen.
You'll get over it.
My 5-year-old.
The kids love the iPad and the other large screen things. They're pretty good size.
Which brings us back around to the question I raised at the very beginning. I can't let you go without asking you to respond directly to this conundrum I raised. Parents are supposed to be limiting their kids' screen time. They're also supposed to be encouraging them to read. When those two are one and the same, what are you supposed to do?
There's good screen time and bad screen time. What if your 5-year-old, 6-year-old is just motivated and excited to read the encyclopedia? What's wrong with that?
Dan Pointer and author Roxy Monroe talking about the future of children's books.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1, go!
That's the sound of a world record being set. Specifically, most chromatic scales played in harmony on a xylophone and a bass in 1 minute. 66 times. Now, this record is nowhere to be found in the Guinness Book, but rather on the website Record Setter. The site accepts feats in almost any category you can think of, such as most ketchup packets squeezed in 30 seconds, or most people simultaneously flossing on one length of dental floss. Ugh. Well, Dan Rollman is co-founder and president of RecordSetter.com, and I asked him where he was when he got the idea.
I always say Record Setter began when I was a 10-year-old boy and got my first Guinness Book of World Records and just fell in love with world records. And in 2004, I was at the Burning Man Festival in Nevada, which is built around a culture of creativity and participation. So my friends and I went out and decided to set up a world record camp where people could come up and climb onto a stage and invent their own world records. So, you know, a guy came up with an accordion and set the world record for the fastest accordion rendition of The Devil Went Down to Georgia. And a woman came up and she had a whole bunch of blueberries and an extraordinarily deep belly button and set the record for the most blueberries inside a belly button.
I don't even know if I want to see the photographic evidence of that.
You can find it on our site.
So the record still stands.
Both of those records still stand. But then we started to see a lot of competition in categories. And then it just felt like people were having so much fun with the creative side of thinking what they could be a world champion at. I thought there was an opportunity to take this thing onto the internet and invite the whole world to play along.
Well, you mentioned the Guinness Book of World Records, which is kind of the gorilla in the room here. Why did you feel like there needed to be something else in addition to that?
I think looking at us as kind of the Wikipedia to Guinness's Encyclopedia Britannica is a good analogy. I looked into setting a Guinness World Record when I was in college. I really wanted to get into the book and be recognized, and I just found that the level of difficulty with the paperwork and so forth that was necessary. And
I can't let you go any further without asking, what was the record that you were trying to set?
I looked into ravioli eating for a little while. I thought I could make a run at being a competitive ravioli eater. I was also trying to impress a girl.
And did it work?
It didn't work on either level.
What was wrong with her? I can't imagine that plan failing.
Yeah, you know, some guys woo women with roses and chocolate, and I said, come on over and watch me speed eat ravioli.
Is there anything, any record that somebody's proposed that's just too weird?
The short answer is no. We have principles. You know, we're trying to raise the bar of human achievement through world records. So we have principles, the primary one being don't hurt yourself, don't hurt others, don't hurt the planet. But in terms of being too weird, we love that stuff.
Are you setting one right now, even as we speak, Dan Rollman?
I am not in the midst of setting a world record, but I recently set the record for the tallest Tower of Clementine pieces, which I think stands at 6 or 7. If anyone out there wants to have a go at that, they can find the video on Record Setter, and I welcome anyone out there to have a go at taking me down.
A challenge for the weekend. Thanks so much, Dan Rollman.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dan Rollman. He is co-founder and president of recordsetter.com. And if you want to check out that picture and video, you can head to our website, npr.org. I have just walked outside the main NPR headquarters building, and we're in downtown DC. It is a bright, clear day. I've just laced up my sneakers because I'm about to get chased by zombies. All right, now. This is a new game. We're going to test it out here. And I've got a button here, start mission. All right, here we go.
So you'll see the township as we look round. Not much more than a few fences to keep the zombies out.
All right, so not sure which is going to be the bigger danger here, getting caught by the zombies or the traffic that's heading my way from Mass Ave. Let's
Listen,
pick it up.
If you're alive, if there's anyone alive.
Oh yeah, I'm
this
alive.
This is Sam Yao from Able Township. You've come down in a nest of hostiles.
Hostiles?
They've heard the noise. They're coming. There are 30... Oh, no, 40.
Oh, dear. That does not sound good.
Your only safe path is towards the tower.
The tower.
You should be able to see that from where you are.
I see
a safe
way.
If there's anyone alive there, just
run. I see Chipotle.
Run!
Run! I'm running! I'm running! I'm running! So happily, I did manage to outrun the zombies that time and live to tell the tale. It is all part of a new running game called Zombies Run, and it's designed to encourage folks to exercise. The game is the brainchild of British writer Naomi Alderman, and she says the idea came to her when she signed up for a class for amateur runners.
The start of the course, they said to us, why do you want to learn how to run? And one woman said, I want to be able to outrun the zombie horde. Then I thought, this would be a good idea for a game.
Well, I got a little bit of a taste of it this morning. I was doing laps around the NPR building. And I was very focused on not getting caught by the zombies. But I gather I was also supposed to be on some sort of mission collecting things. Explain to us how this game works.
So the idea is you are runner 5. You come from a small base, the last shivering remnant of humanity. You have to go out running, or you can do it by walking. We want to be open to people of all fitness levels. You have to go out to collect supplies for your base. So as you're going, it goes, bing, you got some toilet paper. Bing, you got some bottled water. And when you get back home on your phone, you'll see, okay, you picked up 7 batteries, allot them to a different place in the base. So that gives every run that feeling of, I'm doing something important, I'm growing my base. There's also an ongoing story where at some point somebody will say to you, runner 5, runner 5, there's a child stuck in no man's land. Land. Run, run, run to get them before the zombies come.
Rawr.
So these are all these voices that I was hearing as I was running, giving me specific instructions and speed up and slow down. And I have to admit, I mean, you know, it gets you moving. I think I managed to complete level one. But if you stick with it, you're going to go through various levels and keep getting different assignments. But they're all going to involve trying to get away from the zombies. Is that right?
They are.
And one thing I was worried about was, okay, I'm running my fastest, but I don't know if these zombies are sub-6-minute milers or what.
There are different speeds of zombies. Basically, we have something that is called hardcore mode, where if you switch it on, then, yeah, the zombies are going to chase you, but you can also turn off hardcore mode. And then there's
just
a zombie
story. Yeah, I was definitely not in hardcore mode. I was in still need my coffee mode.
Excellent.
I was a bit worried before I went out and actually did it, how you do a game just through a narrative, not, you know, no images that you're looking at here.
Yeah, that was very important to us, because there are other sort of running games that might, like, put some kind of monster in your path, but you have to be looking at the screen in order to see it. And we were just like, this is not safe. So that was where we started. We started with the idea that we wanted to do something where it was all audio. And I would say also, if you have the hardcore mode on where zombies are going to catch you, we very strongly advise you not to do it in traffic.
Not to do it. That was my fatal error. Near fatal error,
oh, no!
I should say, as I was out testing it. Now, I did manage not to get caught by the zombies. Tell me exactly what happens if they catch you.
Well, the first time they catch you, it's just going to say the zombie has caught you. But after a number of times that they catch you, then you have failed this mission. You have to start the mission again,
which
means more running. So, you know, good for your heart.
Which is the whole point here anyway, so there you go.
Well, exactly.
That's writer Naomi Alderman. She writes a weekly column on games and technology for the Guardian newspaper, and she created the new game Zombies Run. The app is out for the iPhone February 27th. Naomi, thanks for a great workout.
Great talking to you.
In war-torn Congo, the heart of Africa, a convoy of private military contractors carrying a U.S. senator to a secret mine is about to run into trouble.
In the middle car, the package is still staring out of the window, a look of horror forming on his face. It's as though the anticipation has spread, as though it's a virus or a stain, alive somehow, crimson and thirsty. Ray swallows. He's thirsty himself, the feeling in his veins now inexorable, like a dark, slowly uncoiling sexual desire that senses imminent release. He puts his finger on the trigger.
That shooting is the first strand in a complicated web that makes up our book this week, the new thriller Bloodland. Author Alan Glynn, that's his voice you just heard, unfolds a story of corruption and murder and cover-ups. And Alan Glynn joins us now from Dublin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So tell me, in just a few seconds, what's the book about?
The book is a political thriller which takes us from Dublin via New York to the Congo. It deals with illegal mining of metals in the Congo and the relationship that they have to corporate boardrooms in New York. It's an exploration of the power dynamics that go on between these two things.
A lot of manipulation of power and shady backroom deals and all this. Well, I was so struck by, you do have all these kind of grand themes, as you just mentioned. But instead of, you know, lecturing about them from lofty heights, you really take it down to these, just, you have this great cast of quite seedy characters, people who are outwardly powerful but inwardly have their issues. Was that a deliberate way to tell the story?
Yeah, I think the danger with something like this is to be polemical. If you start with an agenda, a political agenda, in fiction, you're asking for trouble. It's important to kind of not preach, even though at the heart of the story there is a kind of a political point, I think. But what really interests me is the psychology of these people in these positions of power. And characters which, you know, on the surface, on the page, might seem extremely unsympathetic. I think by getting close to the way they think, there's a certain ambivalence that comes out, which is interesting.
Which character did you have the most fun writing?
I like James Vaughan, the character. He's a kind of a grey eminence, if you like, behind the book.
And he's the international financier, right? Kind of
yes.
a George Soros gone bad.
Yeah, he runs a private equity company called the Oberon Capital Group. He's a guy in his early 80s. He's been around for a long time. And I'm just fascinated by someone who's been so involved on so many levels of the power structures in the way the world has developed to today.
without giving away any of the twists and turns in your book, it is safe to say that a lot of the characters here make very bad choices. That, you know, they land in trouble, and it's entirely of their own making.
Yes, and then they make further choices which get them further into kind of knottier trouble spots, which is fun, I think, fun to write, and it's fun to watch how they dig deeper into the hole that they're in.
Let me ask you to focus in on one of them, and this is the character Larry Bulger. He, until quite recently in your book, was Prime Minister of Ireland. He's now out of a job, and he's also an alcoholic who had not had a sip in a decade until now. And you have a great scene in there where you describe him in his living room. He's standing in front of his liquor cabinet. He's reached out, and he's touching a bottle of whiskey. I wonder if you would read that passage for us. Page 63.
Sure. He raises the glass to his lips and slurps. Slurps whiskey. The taste of it. The feel of it going down. Oh, my God. He holds the glass in front of him, stares at it in disbelief, raises it to his lips again, takes a couple of genteel sips just for confirmation. Already he can feel it. That burning sensation in his stomach. Already he can feel those familiar cravings, sudden and impatient. For a cigarette, for company, for another sip. He turns around and takes one.
One interesting thing, hearing you read that, it's all in the present tense. It's a little jarring, because most fiction, you realize, is written in the past tense. Why did you choose to do it that way?
You say most fiction is in the past. I suppose it is, but there is a pretty good tradition of writing in the present tense. Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow is written in the present tense. It's more immediate, and we're swept along, I think, with the events of the story in a more immediate way.
I'm speaking with Alan Glynn about his new thriller, Bloodland. And Alan Glynn, let me ask you about the character, your kind of protagonist, who's the one trying to unravel all of these various twists and turns, is a journalist named Jimmy. And you write, I mean, as a journalist reading this, I thought, wow, he kind of got it right. He gets how it works. Were you ever a journalist yourself?
Oh, thank you. That's good to hear, because no, I haven't been a journalist. I don't think I have what it takes to meet deadlines. I know journalists. I've spoken to some, and it also deals with the whole crisis that's going on at the moment in newspapers, with newspapers closing and all of that stuff. He's kind of bang in the middle of that. He's very young. He's not that experienced, and he's looking for a place in a news organization where he can, you know, do what he wants to do, which is follow a story.
Now, as this young reporter is trying to follow the story, the reader is following along with him, and that's how a lot of the plot twists in the book unfold. I am always fascinated when I speak to writers to find out, did you know what was going to happen? I mean, when you start writing a book like this, do you know how it's all going to end?
No, I don't. I don't really plan in great detail at all. It's... I'm always reminded of that great quote by E.L. Doctorow. He said, writing a novel is like, you know, driving a car at night. You know, you can just see as far as the headlights will show you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I think that keeps it fresh for the writer as well as the reader.
So you're getting to know the characters yourself as you write them on the page. Yeah.
It's kind of a tightrope walk in a way, too, because, you know, it's a confidence trick that you play on yourself as well as the reader. If you look down, you know, you can fall.
We've mentioned this. The action in this book is set largely in Dublin, where you live, and also action unfolds in New York, in Italy. But several of the key scenes are in Africa, in Congo, a place I'm assuming you have not personally lived in. How do you deal with that challenge of describing a place that you haven't yourself gotten to know very well?
I did a lot of research. And also the scenes in the Congo are filtered through characters who are not from there. And I think that helped me a bit, too.
You're not trying to write in the voice of an African. But on the other hand, it's fiction. I mean, you could make up whatever you want. How
absolutely.
How important is it to you to get it absolutely right?
Absolutely. 100% accuracy is not so important. I mean, I think James Joyce kind of, you know, flogged that horse to death, really. You know, when he wrote Ulysses, everything had to be inch perfect. Everything he described, he used to write home to his relatives to measure things in the street, you know. So I think once he did that, you know, it was left open after that for anybody to make it up as you go along. But you want to get it right to a certain extent.
Well, again, without wanting to give away any of the twists and turns that unfold on these pages, I think I can safely say that at the end of this one, it seems as though you're setting us up for an epic battle between two of the characters, your reporter hero Jimmy and the wicked Jimmy Vaughn. Are we going to see these characters again?
Yes. The third novel in the... It's kind of a loose trilogy, I've described it. The books could be read separately, but I think they will go together quite well. The third one is called Graveland. I deal with the character of James Vaughn in quite a lot of detail in this new book through his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, back as far as the 1870s and the railroads. It sounds pretty ambitious, but we'll see how it goes.
You've got your work cut out for you.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll look forward to that one. Alan Glynn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
That's Alan Glynn talking about his latest novel, Bloodland, and we just spoke with him from the studios of RTE in Dublin. On the subject of plots, here's a pretty complicated one. A woman watches the Gulf oil spill washing up on her doorstep. Meanwhile, hundreds of miles away, a flood threatens her hometown. Also, a friend of 30 years takes his own life. And her child announces he's transgender. All in the course of 1 year. Now, that's no novel. It all actually happened to Gretchen Peters in 2010. Some of us might crumble under the weight of so many life-changing events, but Peters was able to channel them. The two-time Grammy-nominated songwriter put pen to paper and wrote the album of her career.
I'm a soldier back from war, too tired to care no more, too sad to put up any kind of fight.
That's our music story for today. Gretchen Peters' new album is called Hello, Cruel World.
I sort of approached the writing on the album not in terms of so much writing, you know, here's a song about this, here's a song about the flood, and here's a song about my son, and so forth. It was more that the emotional earthquakes that were happening in that year informed all of the songs. But I will say that I certainly felt sort of raw and clarified in a way by all of these events, as major life events will do to you. I felt that I was craving the truth, and I wanted to tell the truth, and I wanted the truth to be, you know, brutally honest.
We ought to take what earthly comfort we can find.
You mentioned that you don't tend to write a song about a specific event. It's more speaking to kind of the place where you were at the moment. But there is something in having a song on here called Natural Disaster, written in a year when you had two literally wash up on your doorstep. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Earthquake shook California ground. Took a freeway out and some buildings down. I never felt the earth move under my heels, but I got a pretty good idea how it feels.
Describe for us what actually happened to you, how you were actually affected by these two disasters in Nashville and on the Gulf Coast back in 2010.
Well, I think what happens, you know, primarily is a feeling of helplessness, and it's like a huge reminder from the universe that you're not in control of anything, really. And the flood in Nashville was devastating, but it was very fickle. I mean, Nashville's a hilly place, and you could walk down one street and it would look completely normal, such as our street where our house is, and literally turn the corner and another street would be under 20 feet of water. And that was just so profoundly disorienting and horrifying to see. And the oil spill, I'd hasten to say, was obviously not a natural disaster, but a man-made one.
Sure.
But it was a similar feeling. It was this feeling of utter helplessness, and it went on and on and on. And I think it really did, though, more than anything for me, just reinforce the fact that we are not in control of our natural world or really anything. And I wanted to explore that in these songs, and certainly that was what was coming out of me.
Weatherman says no chance of rain. I'm still waiting for that hurricane.
We're speaking with singer and songwriter Gretchen Peters about her latest album. It's called Hello, Cruel World. Let me ask you some more about your son. You wrote quite eloquently about how he revealed to you that he was transgendered in a piece in the Huffington Post. Let me read just a little bit of that. You wrote, "This is the child to whom I gave a girl's name, imbued with my own girlish hopes, nurtured the mother-daughter bond that I had with my own mother, a bond based, it seemed to me, on our common gender. What was my relationship with this person if he is my son?" What did you figure out was the answer to that question? Because we should say this, he was 26 when you were having this conversation.
Right. Well, the answer is I have a much more real relationship with my son now because my son is able to be real with me. There was a wall between us, essentially. The wall was built because he didn't feel that he could reveal his truth. And I would hasten to say that's through no fault of his own, but I guess the world. It's profoundly disorienting at first. And there are still occasionally times when I feel sort of, wait, what just happened? Although not much. The thing that about it that really struck me is when he told me, there was a very big part of me that recognized that it was true instantly. And I think I wrote in the Huffington Post piece, it was like I felt the tumblers and a lock just fall into place. Everything about his life and his childhood made sense to me.
Your bleeding heart, your pilgrim soul, your wounded eyes, they take their toll, your ragged voice. Like a broken bell against the noise, my dark angel.
Looking back now on that turbulent year, 2010, now that you have a little bit of distance, what do you think you learned about yourself?
I think that beyond the obvious, which is that I'm strong. Clearly, I was able to get through things that I perhaps thought I wouldn't be able to get through. I think the other thing was that it softened me in some way. I think when you have these huge life-changing events, it sort of clarifies things, and what you realize is what's truly important, which is your relationships, the people that you love. And as a writer, I think we've all been through a year like that. So it's a comforting thing, in an odd way, to hear it from someone else, to hear, yes, you know, I've been through this and I've been through this and I'm still here. And that survival really is the real heroism. It's not about jumping from building to building or, you know, rescuing puppies or whatever. It's that really the heroes in these songs are heroes because they survive.
That's Gretchen Peters. Her latest album is called Hello, Cruel World. You can check out a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Gretchen Peters, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Haven't done as well as I thought I would. I'm not dead, but I'm damaged goods. And it's getting late. I'm a rusty hinge, a squeaky wheel. Bad end of a shaky deal.
For the week ending February 19th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Petra Mayer and edited by Mithoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Tasneem Shama, Megan Kane, Becky Sullivan, and Kenya Young. Lauren Benishu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.
For some concern. Don't live this long without regrets. Telephone calls you don't want to get. Stones you'd rather leave unturned. Sand. got to go. Me, I'm gonna stick around, in for a penny, in for a pound, 'cause I hate to miss the show.